Well, then what makes you so special?
Hang on, Chuck. That's the question I want to save for the show.
This episode is sponsored by Hired.com. Every week on Hired, they run an auction where over 1,000 tech companies in San Francisco, New York, and LA bid on Ruby developers, providing them with salary and equity up front. The average Ruby developer gets an average of 5 to 15 introductory offers and an average salary offer of $130,000 a year. Users can either accept an offer and go right into interviewing with the company or deny them without any continuing obligations. It's totally free for users, and when you're hired, they give you a $2,000 signing bonus as a thank you for using them. But if you use the Ruby Rogues link, you'll get a $4,000 bonus instead. Finally, if you're not looking for a job but know someone who is, you can refer them to Hired to get a $1,337 bonus if they accept a job. Go sign up at hired.com/rubyrogues. This episode is sponsored by CodeChip.com. Don't you wish you could simply deploy your code every time your test passed? Wouldn't it be nice if it were tied to a nice continuous integration system? That's CodeChip. They run your code. If all your tests pass, they deploy your code automatically. For fuss-free continuous delivery, check them out at CodeChip.com. Continuous delivery made simple. Snap is a hosted CI and continuous delivery that is simple and intuitive. Snap's deployment pipelines deliver fast feedback and can push healthy builds to multiple environments automatically or on demand. Snap integrates deeply with GitHub and has great support for different languages, data stores, and testing frameworks. Snap deploys your application to cloud services like Heroku, DigitalOcean, AWS, and many more. Try Snap for free. Sign up at snapci.com/rubyrogues. This episode is sponsored by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean is the provider I use to host all of my creations. All the shows are hosted there, along with any other projects I come up with. Their user interface is simple and easy to use, their support is excellent, and their VPSs are backed on solid-state drives and are fast and responsive. Check them out at DigitalOcean.com. If you use the code RubyRogues, you'll get a $10 credit. Hey, everybody, and welcome to episode 203 of the Ruby Rogues podcast. This week on our podcast, we have Saran Yitbar.
Hey, everybody.
David Brady.
There once was a man from Peru whose limericks all ended on line two.
I'm Charles Max Wood from DevChat.tv. We've got a special guest this week, and that is Sean Fiorito. Did I say that right?
Totally. You nailed it.
You want to introduce yourself really quickly?
Sure. Let's see. I'm a developer. I've been like professional developer for the last 10 years. About 2 years ago, I quit my day job and started working full time on a couple different products that I do. And I do a little bit of consulting as well. That's basically what I do in a nutshell.
We brought you on today to talk about design and sketching with CSS.
Right.
And I know you have the book Sketching with CSS.
Right.
Do you want to kind of give us a thumbnail on that, and then we can start talking about some of the design stuff?
Totally. I'll give you like kind of a background at the problem designers are facing these days, and then sort of the challenges that they run into, and that's how the book helps them. But the issue is designers, for the longest time, a web designer's job used to be to create what they called comps with Photoshop. So they get a project, they'd create a design comp in Photoshop, and then they'd give this basically picture of a website. They hand it off to a front-end developer who would then slice it up and create a version of the website with CSS and HTML. So that worked for a very long time because for the longest time, the web was running on basically the same machine over and over again. Like, remember those like beige PC boxes with the floppy disk drive? It's running like i6, i7, you know, standard monitor, very homogenous. And of course, that is not what the web looks like anymore at all today. It's running everywhere. And so websites are expected to run on all different kinds of devices. And so that's a challenge for a web designer who is still using Photoshop as their primary tool. In fact, it doesn't really work. And so for a while now, for a couple years, there's been this, I guess I'll call it a mantra, that web designers should design in the browser. And so this is this idea that web designers should skip using a tool like Photoshop altogether, maybe do some sketches, something like that, and then start creating their comps in code directly. And it's a good idea, right? Because, you know, as you're writing code, you can actually see the site as it develops and like load it on all kinds of different devices and see what it's going to look like and sort of build it from the ground up to work on all these different devices. The problem is that the adjustment going from using Photoshop all day to all of a sudden going straight to code that's a real big problem for a lot of web designers. And that's because a lot of web designers, kind of most of them, know how to code enough at least to get, you know, some version of a website working. But the big problem then comes when they need to sit down and be creative while writing code at the same time. And a lot of web designers find that nearly impossible. And that's because there's just this whole wall of like technical stuff that they have to get over in order to get a pixel on the screen. There's just so much work that they have to do before they can even see any sort of result in their browser as they're starting. And then there's also a huge learning curve. If you guys do front-end stuff, you know that the world of front-end development has exploded in the last couple of years. And if you're experienced with it, it's hard to sort of see that it's really complicated if you're just coming at it, you know, as a beginner. So there's this huge, massive learning curve. So then the book is essentially, it's like a light version of front-end development. It's specifically designed for web designers who are creating prototypes in the browser. So it's like all the tools that you can use, picking and choosing only the stuff that's going to help you get pixels to the screen faster. And that's it's basically, I'm creating a set of tools that's easy to learn and gets out of your way pretty quickly once you kind of get the basic idea of how they work. So then you can sort of, it's a lot easier to be writing code and then see these results as you're working. So that's the notion of the book, if that makes sense. So does it make sense now that I'm not a designer?
That is actually very cool. And yeah, I was waiting to pounce on you with, well, if you're not a designer, what are you doing writing a book about design? But that actually makes total sense to me as a programmer, which is probably a bad thing from a design perspective.
I was actually going to say, this sounds really great for complicating the lives of our designers, but I'm a programmer. So does it work the other way? Like for me, moving more toward design to make design more approachable. Because I look at design and I'm just like, yeah, colors.
Yeah.
And images and colors.
Well, okay. So think about it this way. I think that there's, right. I think
fonts. Yeah.
That's a limited language that developers should learn in order to be able to communicate with designers. And it doesn't mean you have to be an expert designer, but I think that there's a core set of concepts which you can learn to a certain degree, which would then make it easier for you to work with designers, if that makes sense. And so it's kind of the same thing applied the other direction from designers to developers. And that is, you know, because that is one of the things with the book is that, and that was sort of controversial. I've had a lot of front-end developers complaining about this, but it's not the code that I say they should create at the end of it is not something that's necessarily going to make it into production. Like if you're only working with modern browsers, then probably. But I eschew it to like talking about or worrying about maintenance, worrying about performance, that sort of thing, code readability, stuff like that. I think that stuff is not important to the designer who's creating a prototype. But the big thing is, and the thing that I tell everybody is that, you know, okay, a designer that can actually do that, that can give you code that works and understands how this stuff all fits together, they may not be able to think about it at the level that a more experienced front-end developer does eventually. But the designer that knows how to do that can have that conversation with, can work way better with a developer, if that makes sense. So in my opinion, I would rather get code that's not necessarily ready for production versus just a Photoshop comp. I mean, I don't know if you guys have ever had to do that, but it's not, you know, there's a lot of gaps between like a Photoshop document and then a website and then designers that don't know how websites work. So I think this is a big move forward for a lot of web designers.
I completely agree. I mean, I can tell you that I've had nightmares about, you know, hide this layer, hide that layer, hide this other layer in Photoshop, right? So that you get all the text off so that you can get the background. And then if you don't slice it just right, then it's almost the right size. So then I have to go back and get the original and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, the other issue is with responsive sites, I mean, that's effectively 2, 3, 4 designs. And so, so then you're dealing with all of that. Okay. Well, you know, now I have to go into Photoshop and figure out how to squeeze it all together. And if a designer was just getting in there and it's like, okay, make your browser half the width of the screen. Okay. Now what we want to do is make it look pretty again. And those are the words that I use, right? Is pretty and usable. Those are the words I throw at designers. But you know, so then if they can just see it and understand, okay, you're just kind of put this, You know, I can manage the media query, just save right. it off to somewhere else. But
right.
yeah.
And so have you had a lot of experience sitting down and working with designers and creating the code kind of as they're telling you what to do? Is that something you've done?
Not really.
Because that's where I'm coming from. I did that.
That would be nice.
For years at my last job, they, for some reason, well, I don't know. It's kind of smart, actually. The managers at this company I worked at sort of figured out that an interactive prototype of something was way more valuable to convincing other people to do a feature than, you know, just like pictures and mockups and stuff like that. So they would send designers over to me, sit next to me, and then the designers would sit there and tell me, you know, what they wanted. And then I would have to try and make it happen on the screen as fast as possible while writing code. The idea was to do like, you know, create like a really quick turnaround on
that.
These
sounds
things.
Awful.
It was challenging.
Sounds really annoying.
It was really challenging. And at first it would be like, oh, one of the designers, her name was Kiki, and she was always really annoyed with me because she would sit there and like start like messing around on her iPhone or whatever because it was taking me so long to actually get something to show up. But eventually I figured out that I needed to toss out like a bunch of stuff that I was doing that had nothing to do with creating this prototype. And when I did that, it really freed me up. And actually I totally enjoy working that way now because there's all this stuff that I was used to thinking about while I'm creating a site that goes out the window when you're just creating a prototype. So, you know, cutting back the tools to the very basic essentials and stuff that you get used to using. It's something that I talk about in the book, like muscle memory. Like once you get to the point where you're comfortable enough with the tools, then it just sort of happens. You know, like it's a lot easier to get the code out, to get the design on the screen more quickly. But anyway, I don't know. I like it. I really do like cranking out prototypes like that.
Sean, be honest. Did you write this book so that Kiki can code her own stuff? Is that what it's all about?
I haven't bought the book. I've been waiting for them to buy it, but they haven't.
That's actually kind of a very programmatic way to do it, right? It's like it used to be go away or I will replace you with a very short Perl script. Well, now it's go away or I will write a book to teach you how to replace yourself with a very short Perl script.
And I'll make you buy it.
Yes.
So I completely understand and appreciate the pain point. I was, you know, very, very comfortable with Photoshop for many, many years before knowing anything about code. And, you know, I would naturally do my mockups and my design stuff in Photoshop and then translate it into code, which was annoying and painful and very, very slow. I had nightmares about layers as well. And when I talked to designers, they told me that they actually don't use Photoshop anymore. They use things like Sketch and InVision and all these other tools that were kind of meant to feel more webby,
right.
but not, and you'll be a lot more simple and not do, you know, they don't really use Photoshop anymore. So I'm wondering, why is understanding CSS and doing it your way, why is that better than those other not Photoshop alternatives?
Well, okay. I don't know if I'd say that it's better. It's a different solution. The tools are basically solving the same problem that I'm going after, right? So there's a couple ways that you could go after it. I think, and I've messed around with some of these tools, not too much, but a little bit, but I think that they still are one layer of abstraction too far for the most part. And I think that it would be okay if you were familiar with what was happening. Like, if you actually understood, like, what the tool was doing at a deep enough level, then fine, use the tool. It's like this with programming stuff, too, right? Like, the law of leaky abstractions. Like, you can only go so far, you know, up the chain of abstraction before, you know, eventually something pops through at you and you have no idea what it means. And so that's a problem. So I think that you should be comfortable with the one level below, right? And actually know, like, what's going on. You don't necessarily have to do that at that level. Maybe the tool is faster for you, but you should at least be comfortable with it. So that's always what I think about with these tools. There's another one called Macaw, which you didn't mention, but that one's pretty popular. You know, and then code, like, tools that generate HTML always scare me. I don't even, you know what I mean? Like, I'm a little dubious about that. We'll see what happens. But like I said, I haven't seen what these things do. And then also another, like, in the book, I don't recommend using frameworks at all, like Bootstrap, that sort of thing, right? And that's because I think that, and frameworks and tools sort of have the same problem, that they put you in a box because you have constraints of the tool. And so your designs end up being constrained by the tool or the framework or whatever it is that you're using. And it's hard to think outside of it. So like as soon as you run into a thing that it's not obvious how you're going to do it with the tool, then you're not willing to, or there's a lot of resistance to figuring out how you're going to make it work. It's so a lot of times you'll just end up going with the grain of the tool, and therefore that limits the design. I think that's one of the reasons why Bootstrap sites and sites with other frameworks and stuff end up looking the same, because it's just easier to do kind of what it has laid out for you, which I think is good. It's good for code, right? But I don't think that that's necessarily good for design. I guess it depends on how you think about it.
So how do you feel about things like grid systems and CSS resets?
Okay, so a reset is incredibly helpful from a prototyping perspective. So then I don't necessarily think that you should have a reset in production code, but to start with a clean slate where you're not battling, you end up basically, if you don't use a reset, you end up like resetting all this stuff every single time you do it anyway, right? Yeah. So you might as well just start with a clean slate and then sort of add on with the reset. So from a prototyping perspective, cool with resets. And then grid systems. Okay, my problem with grid systems is that, again, this goes back to this, it's one level of abstraction too high. So I do teach in the book, I teach designers how to create their own grid system. And I think that's a big difference versus like use your own grid system or use a grid system and learn how to use a grid system versus build your own. Then you have a much deeper understanding of what's going on. And then also, like, it's not that hard to build a grid system that does a lot of stuff for you. And I think a lot of designers don't know that because they're scared of these kinds of things seem really intimidating. One of the reasons I think these things are really intimidating is because a lot of times these frameworks and tools are built by really, really experienced developers for much bigger problems. So like a really experienced developer can see, they can take all of the problems that they've run into in the course of their career and then abstract it so that they have this tool that can cover all of these problems. And that's awesome. That's amazing. So then you end up with a tool that can work in a lot of different situations. But then that's very intimidating for somebody who doesn't have that level of experience because there's all the stuff. And what do you ignore? What do you need to know? How does it work? Etc. So that's one of the big challenges with all these front end tools.
So as a developer, let's say that I have some app that I want to build. So if I want to start prototyping in this way, where do I get started?
Okay, you're prototyping.
Let's just say that I'm going to prototype forum software online.
Okay. So this is something that a designer might call a workflow, right? And designers need to have this notion of how do I, and this is something people ask me all the time, is like, okay, so how does this fit into like an actual project? Like, where do I start? At what point do I write code? What point should I write code? And I think that, and I'll try and answer you more specifically, but sort of general answer here is that the way you approach this totally depends on the company that you work for, your client, the project. And I think every company, agency, studio needs to sit down and to decide like how they're going to work with clients. Like if it's just you and it's only you that is working on a project, that's kind of a weird scenario. But say we're building this for someone else, right? So can I do that? Can I say we're building this for someone else?
Sure.
Okay. So the important thing is, the way I would do it is I would start with actually just talking about like the functionality of like what I want this forum to be able to do. So we start there. And then we start with sketches like on paper. Again, not a designer, right? So this is like, I know this is what designers do. So I could say this. And so I would start with these sketches, but then, okay. The point that you get to code, and I think it should be sooner rather than later, would be once you've sort of uncovered some of these main features. And then I think what you should do is start picking off small components that you can start knocking out as prototypes. So you start talking about like the interaction of what does it look like when, probably for a form, you're going to like look at what does it look like just to display all of the threads and like all the information that we talked about display. How is it going to look like when somebody replies? We're going to have nested threads, all of that stuff, right? So I'd just start with that and like no ability to actually add posts or anything like that. And I would just start with what is this like initial, like laying out the posts and then getting rapid feedback on that. And then go from there to adding on the other stuff, like adding posts, like what's this form going to look like that we're going to actually be adding stuff into. And then, and what's great about that is I have a friend who's an interaction designer, and it's amazing to me whenever I talk to him, like all of the things, the thought that can go into a form, like even the most simple form. And then the ability to like knock out a prototype that you can actually see, you know, how this might play out and what this might look like, is really, really handy to have. But anyway, so that's kind of my suggestion. So like the overall, my thought is like, you should create small components and build the site and what kind of like one feature at a time, if that makes sense.
Makes sense to me.
You know, one tool that you probably all use that I talk about that I teach designers how to do is Git. And like one of the things I think that's interesting is, so all these tools that I talk about that I teach designers how to use, they're designed for developers by developers. And that's a really huge problem for somebody who's not a developer, especially like a tool like Git. So one of the things I like to joke about, well, it's not really a joke, it's reality. Like Linus Torvalds wrote Git for himself for the Linux kernel for like merging thousands of lines of code every day. That's what he does. And every freaking Git tutorial starts out with like learning about, you know, the DAG and like all this stuff, which is interesting to me and probably you guys too. But for somebody that just needs to use the tool on their project, it's ridiculous. Like that's totally not what they need. So what I do for Git and for some of the other tools too is basically like, here is the commands that you should use, and you should use them in this order, and you do these things in these situations, basically like this cheat sheet. And so you don't actually even need to know how it works, and you get most of the bang for your buck with Git. And then what I've discovered happens is, because a lot of people have a lot of success with learning Git this way, they get really excited because finally they can actually use Git. Like it's been, you know, they've probably tried before and it hasn't worked. And then they get excited, and then it's a lot easier for them to go on and learn. And so at the root of this, I think, is developers suck at writing documentation. Like that's basically how I make a living, is what I've discovered, is developers are just terrible at writing docs for everything, which I find disconcerting because it's like a basic communication skill, right? Should be also in our code too. I think about that a lot. Like should like developers, I feel like, should know more how to communicate how their tools work, why they work, and how to teach them to people. And that should also affect, I think, how they write code. What do you guys think about that?
I've never been good about writing documentation. So whether or not I'm good at writing documentation is a completely other question. But mainly it's because I'm focused on solving the problem. So once I have the problem solved, I go refactor my code. I just want to be done. You know, I want to go write more code. Writing documentation is a whole lot less fun. And I think several other developers that I've spoken with kind of feel the same way. And to be honest, I'm just kind of lazy about it. So,
yeah, I don't mind writing documentation because I've been, you know, on the other end of that, you know, fairly frequently where I'm the one being frustrated. So I appreciate it. It's more of maintaining it. It's more of, you know, if I decide to do it, I'll do it for an hour or however long it takes. I have everything ready. But then when things change, remembering to go back and, you know, keep it up to date. That's the hardest part for me.
Keeping documentation up to date?
Right, correct. As things change. Mm-hmm.
Totally agree. One of the ways I like to think about that is I think there should be like two kinds of documentation. So, and I see this a lot, but it's not done really well. But there should be like, so there's documentation where you're saying how literally everything in your entire code base works, which you need, right? Describing all the APIs, describing, you know, all of these things. So that's kind of describing the how, which is, you know, you need that. Once you're familiar with why the tool is organized the way that it is, then you need to be able to go back to these.
I'm going to push back on that just a little bit.
Sure.
I think the documentation is definitely important for some of that in certain circumstances, but I have seen teams make great use of things like style guides and just understanding the way that they craft their code and put things together, and then good naming to make it so that for the most part, you really don't need the documentation. You can just go look at the code.
Right. But, okay. So, but that's just another way to have that kind of documentation put in your code.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's the same thing.
But
they're still missing.
There are always instances where there's just not a good way to make the code communicate what it's doing. And, you know, I think with more practice, some of those can get better. And with some of those, there's just no way. And so in those cases, yeah, you need something that says, here's how you use this.
Okay. But that's helping you understand how the code works, not how to actually get things done. So I guess in this case, I'm talking about tools that you use, mm-hmm. not necessarily like documentation for tools that we use. So that's a little different.
Okay.
Okay. So like what's missing is, I think most of the time, what's missing is having a person in mind, an objective that they would like to achieve, and then getting them to achieve that objective with your tool. And that's the big piece that I see missing from documentation all the time. And then I see a lot of like tutorials, getting started guides, things like that. Most of them are terrible for most tools, you know, unless we're lucky.
If they're even up to date.
Exactly. So there's this challenge of finding an up-to-date tutorial and then finding one that actually is going to help you achieve the goal that you're looking to achieve. Something that doesn't make you feel like an idiot. And that's another problem. Like, for some reason, I don't know, it's just the way we are as developers, but a lot of our tutorials and guides tend to make people feel dumb, that, you know, especially when they can't understand what's going on. A lot of it's just assuming, you know, too much, basically. Yeah. So that's a lot of like what I do. That's what I love doing, actually. I love helping people figure out how to use these things to actually get stuff done that they want to do.
I'm curious, let's say that you're in an organization where they do the methodology where, you know, they go and Photoshop stuff, or even if you go to like 99designs, you wind up getting a Photoshop a lot of times. But let's just go to the company, you know, so their designers do the Photoshop thing, they throw it over the fence, you spend a week chopping it up so that you can, you know, get all the pieces looking the right way, you know, so that the CEO is happy because he blessed the design and he's super excited to see it out there. How do you get them to start adopting practices where they, for lack of a better way of putting it, start making the designers write code?
Piece of cake. I mean, all it would take is one presentation with a working example of something that, like an interactive example of a feature or something that they're doing. And this is like more valuable when you're working with an application, something that's going to have like interactions. I mean, so the place that I worked at where we did this, it was like, it was actually like, it's an industrial supply company, which sounds super boring, but it was actually a really fascinating place to work at, but they had this huge website. They sell hundreds of thousands of things. And it's a real challenge to help customers find the exact thing that they want. So they had all kinds of little features and doodads and things to help people narrow down the exact little like screw or strip of metal or whatever it was that they were looking for. And so they were always coming up with different ways to help people do that. So when you're working on that kind of problem, it's basically like, what would happen is the designers would be like, what if we changed this interaction to be, instead of, you know, a list of 50 checkboxes, we made it like a sliding box, you know, something like that. We do stuff like that all the time. And then when you do something like that, what you want to know is like, how are you going to, because as you're changing the sliding box, like the data on the screen is changing. So how should it change in a way that's not confusing to the person that's using this and that actually helps them narrow down their choices? Because so that's usually the kinds of questions that would come up when they would propose these ideas to the CIO, was really hands-on at this place. And so what really helped with them was, instead of what they used to do, is they would create these, and they create these beautiful documents. It was really amazing what they did there, with like really pretty pictures about how everything would work. But then they'd take it in, and then it was like, so what's going to happen? You know, like it was impossible to visualize or explain what's going to happen, like, as things change. And so then all they did was, I remember for one particular feature, they actually just had me implement it so that it would work. You know, we knew it wouldn't work on like every browser or whatever, but it was enough that in this meeting, they could be like, the executive would have a question like, how would this work? And they could be like, well, check this out. And we already thought about this, and they could actually show it. So when you're talking about like stuff like that, as soon as they started doing that, they got over the idea of having pictures of things, and like everybody wanted an interactive demo because it was so much easier to actually talk about and see how the things would work with something that was moving. So then if you have a site that's not moving, that's static, and you're just creating like four different versions of it, I mean, I don't see, you're not going to get that much bang for your buck and going straight to code for doing something like that. So it depends on what the company is doing, I guess, to kind of answer your question. Like if it's like a standard design shop and they're just cranking out responsive sites for lawn mowing services or something like that. You know, it's like small businesses and they're not dealing with like how to display tons and tons of data. It's like real big challenges. And it's just like kind of, I need this to look good at four different screens and it needs to look good on an iPhone, that sort of thing. I'm a pragmatic person. Like that makes sense to me that you could have, if you have the skills in your shop, to have somebody just crank out four different things in Photoshop and then give it to developers and they just create four different versions and do that. You know what I mean? I still think there's a place for that, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think thinking about it, yeah, what I see is, and I'm just going to basically restate what you said, but yeah, when you get a PSD, which is a Photoshop file, or, you know, some other mock-up, it's a static thing. And mm-hmm. So, yeah, you can't get the design on the interaction without a whole lot more work or forward thinking. But if you can actually sit down with somebody and basically say, look, you know, let's try this. Let's try and, you know, interact, you know, with each other and build this up together. Then you can get the full experience that you want and make it all work out for you that way. I like the idea of going and proposing that you work together with somebody and then having it kind of go your way. And, you know, also then you get smooth transitions between states in your application. And this makes a lot of sense for the single page applications that seem to become more and more popular.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that's what we were working with there. And that's what a lot of people are working with now. But you know, the thing is designers do way more than make things look pretty.
Yes.
That's not really what they do. I mean, obviously that's part of the end result. This things look good, but it's more about achieving the objective of whatever this site is. So even I feel like even companies, even places that are making mostly static images, it would still benefit from having designers learn code, even if they still use Photoshop, because I would think that as a designer, I would want to know the medium that I'm working with and know the limitations and constraints of that medium. And even a static site that's relatively simple would benefit from that, from knowing like web fonts, for example, are particularly slow to load on mobile sites, you know, depending on how big it is or whatever. So there's a drawback to using tons of different kinds of fonts, or knowing that, you know, you can't just have an image heavy site if a lot of your users are, you know, loading things up over very slow data networks. So you need to, you know about that. Like that's going to come back and impact your design. So I guess it's kind of going back to what you were saying, like, how do you convince somebody to take on this approach? That's kind of another line of reasoning you could use with somebody. It's like, your designs are pretty half-assed, sorry, if you don't actually know the impact of the design decisions that you're making. So that's part of it. That's a big part of it, too.
I know that the book is made for web designers, not developers, but it also feels like a really good way to get started in development. Like, I know that a lot of front-end developers start off doing design work and kind of slowly find their way into code, and this seems like a really good first step for that, kind of like a, you know, intro to code, doing things that you're already familiar with.
I agree. Although when you're doing something like writing a book, you really have to pick an audience, and you have to, like, in your mind, know who's going to be using this, and then have the courage to stick with it. So the whole time I was writing it, I was thinking, like, yeah, this could be incredibly useful for even, you know, for beginners, also for developers that, like, you know, mostly do backend code that want to add some front end stuff. Like, it's a great place to start there. But yeah, so I had to pick, those people do still buy the book and use it. But I feel like the more of a designer you are and the less you know about code, then the more value you'll get out of the book, because I put more thought into it in that direction. But yeah, I totally agree.
Going back to the, how do you convince people? I think sometimes if you push back on what people are doing, like with a negative criticism, sometimes that kind of, yes, it can challenge them, but it also often can entrench them a little bit, you know, get them to dig in their heels. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I found really useful is to just give a killer demo and have somebody see what it can be like in this other way. You know, so you take somebody who's spitting out PSDs and you say, hey, can we talk about how this is going to work dynamically? And you sit down at your computer and you bring up, you know, the Flexbox, whatever, and you start fiddling with stuff. Now, if it's just here and they animate and they hover over this and this thing moves over here and blah, blah, blah. And then you basically say, can you make me a PSD that has those elements? They go, yeah, I can do that. But they go away also thinking, holy crap, that was awesome. That had, you know, all the pieces to it. You had talked earlier, these two thoughts are kind of joined in my mind about the persuasiveness of a killer demo, because you had talked about sitting down with the customer and working through the objective. And that's what a designer does. It's not just making things look pretty, but it's also making things, you know, work right, making things useful. And I worked with a client about 10 years ago that had a website that you had to click on 17 different things to get to anything. And they only had like 3 different models in their backend. So, I mean, there was no reason to click more than twice on anything to get anywhere in the entire website. And I rebuilt it with this in mind. And this is, you know, like I learned CSS, you know, back in like the late 90s. So when I design a website, it looks like it came from the late 90s. But I'm tempted to pick up your book just so I can learn what all the cool kids are doing these days. I hear you've got rounded corners now. Anyway, but I put up the site, you know, just like in a demo for them. And I got on a conference call with them because I was remote. And we started walking through this. And I knew I had nailed the design. And I had convinced them of my process and of the way things were going to be when I heard the customer lean back away from the phone and shout into the other room, Sandy, get in here. You got to see this. And, you know, and then they asked for, well, what about if we did this change? And of course, this was like one of my first Rails projects. So I made the tweak and, you know, redeployed it. And I'm like, okay, hit reload. And the change was there. And I mean, they were blown away by it. They were completely, yeah, you know, abuzz with it, because the previous developer, anything that they wanted took a month to get the wrong thing every time.
Right.
So,
yeah. So even I've done, so my neighbor, he runs a limo company. And so he really, really wanted me to help him with his website. It's not a thing I would normally do, but I was like, all right, fine. I'll help you with your site. So it's very simple site. The last time he had it done was in the 90s, I think. And this guy took months and months to make it. It has this flash animation of like a limo driving back and forth along the Chicago skyline with this music that he invented for the website with like, had like sparkle images and things.
Oh.
And my neighbor's pretty clueful. He knew that a lot of his customers are, you know, surfing the web on phones, and he was, this wasn't working very well on phones. I mean, he was loading it up on his. And so he knew he needed to work on phones and needed to work on laptops. So I did this approach with it where I, even though it was, again, very static site, I didn't have a limo animation on it. I just created a nice static site. We talked about from the very beginning, like what the objective of the site was. And for him, it's very simple. He wants it on the phone as fast as possible because he's very confident in his salesmanship. So that's how we designed the site. And then I knocked something out that was like, okay, here's kind of like 3 different. So I use something called style tiles, which is something that designers do, that a lot of designers that are taking this design in the browser approach, they create something called style tiles, which is like, here's kind of look and feel what direction we could go. And it's a lot easier to sort of break this out into like, okay, here's like this combination of typefaces with these colors and these kinds of lines and borders and things like that, and these kinds of images. And so you could sort of get like a feel, throw those at him. And
it's like
then
paint chips for the
exactly
web.
Exactly. And then I knocked out a version of his site. Then we sat down, and it was the exact same experience that you had, where because I just created a prototype. I knew this needed to work in lots of different browsers, but I didn't care about that, because the next step that I needed to get to was get this in front of him, and then let's actually make sure that this is kind of what he wants. And a lot of it has to do also with just like getting confidence in, like developing confidence in your abilities as a contractor. And so a lot of that has to do with, you know, communication and having a prototype that works, that you can change on the fly while you're talking with a customer, goes a long way towards developing that confidence in your ability. And yeah, so he was blown away that A, it took a couple days, and B, that we could sit there and just make changes that he wanted to do right there in like a 1 or 2 lines of code change, that sort of thing. So yeah, there's a massive, massive benefit to doing it this way. The other thing, I think a lot of consultants that do design in the browser, like, I read a lot about this, and like one of the big things that they say over and over and over again is that a Photoshop comp is just a picture of a site. Like, it's it's only useful to a certain extent, because sites, even the most simple website, is interactive. You're going to do stuff on it, scroll, read, click on things. There's interactions with this thing. It's a thing that you interact with. And so that you don't get that at all with a comp, with a Photoshop document. And even the most simple website, like my neighbor's limo website, which is like 2 pages, you just simply don't. I don't think a Photoshop document would have achieved the same effect as an actual website that he could see loaded and know that it was an actual, here it is, you know?
Mm-hmm. Plus, I think there's a fluency that's kind of forced upon you at that point, or upon the designer, where, like I joked earlier that, you know, I hear your kids have got, you know, rounded corners now. And if I don't know that and I'm a designer, well, Photoshop's going to let me make arbitrary curves. So I'm going to design a website that's got, you know, elliptical rounded corners, or it's got some weird. And if I'm fluent in CSS and HTML layout, then I can go into that knowing what's already there. And I can go in there and I can make the right call of, do I want elliptical corners bad enough to have an image border versus having the browser actually render rounded corners for me? And if you work in this tool, the fluency is kind of forced upon you, which is great. I can't speak for other people, but I know the best designers I have worked with in the past that have been like pixel Nazis, you know, well, that's the wrong term for it, but you know, people that are,
it's a good term.
people that really want their design to match pixel for pixel.
They call it pixel perfect design. Yeah.
Pixel perfect design. Yeah. And the developers, I just know the term for the developers that have to work for them. We're called pixel pushers because you're pushing things one pixel over, right?
Yeah.
And so you can make that decision of, do I want to push pixels around, or do I just want the sketch to go in and work? And if you really are, you know, a pixel pusher or pixel perfect design, then knowing exactly what the rounded radius will give you for free to the pixel level is perfect.
Right.
And you can trade off for more expensive, fancy stuff. If you want, you have the information to make the right decision about that choice now.
Right. So there's this idea of progressive enhancement. That's something that front-end developers like to talk about. And what's really frustrating is when, and not everybody understands the limitation of the environment, like the web. when people don't understand that, okay, that particular feature only works in these browsers. And so if you need to support something like IE7, IE6, whatever, hopefully nobody's having to do that anymore, your rounded corners are not going to work. And so it's going to look like this. And I think it's a lot easier to get, or would be a lot easier to get designers on board with this idea if they knew and were more comfortable with what you can actually accomplish, like you're saying. Because that's honestly, that's the way you should design for the web, with like this idea that you should have everything looking exactly the same in every browser and every device. You can try to do that, but there's a huge cost to going about that. Like every polyfill is another download and another source of potential bugs and problems and another potential source of slowdowns and maintenance later, right? So yeah, you can pretty much make JavaScript do everything that you want, but there's this huge trade-off. And so I think the more fluent designers can be in code and front-end development, then the easier it is for a front-end developer to have these kinds of conversations.
We did Chuck, the other conference that we did up at the ski resort, just the Ruby Web,
it only happened 1 year.
Yeah, but the Ruby Web conference back in like 2011 or so, or 2010, and BJ Clark spoke at that conference. He's Robot Death Squad on Twitter. He's freaking awesome. And he just stood up and he talked about this notion, and this is 5 years ago, right? But he talked about this notion of trying to make it look the same in all browsers. And he said, just don't, you know, have this progressive enhancement and stop worrying about IE6. And I actually wrote this in my journal, which is why I still have the quote memorized. But he said, people who run IE6 are used to having half the internet look broken anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the last place that I worked at, that was their approach. I mean, so again, kind of taking a pragmatic approach to that. So even though I am a huge fan of progressive enhancement and think that that's the kind of more natural way to create websites and web applications is to think about it that way, there are cases where maybe it makes sense to put a little more effort into making the experience the same for other people with crummier browsers, especially when, you know, 40% of your business is IE7 or something like that. And when you can do a little bit of extra work. So the conversation they had a lot was like, is the benefit that we bring to the customer worth the trade-off of the extra time and hassle that we have putting together this code? So it always does have to come back to the question of the customer, user, whoever's using it, whether you think that the benefit is worth the cost. Most of the time, I don't think, you know, from a business perspective, you don't care as much about your IE6, IE7, IE8, even customers. And, you know, your website can get the job done for them and you don't have to have all of this massive overhead of maintaining different versions, essentially different versions of your site for different browsers. But yeah, it's always a trade-off and it's always worth thinking about. But I think, again, the reason I think that even at this place, if my managers had known more about code and the cost of all of these things, or I guess another thing is if I'd been better at communicating that, front-end developers are better at communicating, then maybe they would favor doing less features for the older browsers more.
Unfortunately, there is a non-zero number of people on this call who still have to support IE6, believe it or not.
No, you're kidding.
Yeah. Oh.
Did you see it? David, did you see BJ replied to your tweet?
Oh, I did not.
He said it's still true up to IE8 now.
Yep. Yep.
What's true up to IE8? I missed that.
I just tweeted, live tweeting parts for the show, and I tweeted the quote about IE6 users seeing half the internet be broken. And he says it's still true up through IE8. That's awesome.
Yeah, totally. IE8 is pretty crummy. IE8's the next IE6 that we have to move on from. I think their next version is going to auto update. I think so.
Microsoft actually announced 3-4 weeks ago that they are killing Internet Explorer.
Well, they're like renaming their browser. I don't know if they're rewriting everything. I doubt that doesn't sound very Microsofty. But
yeah,
I mean, renaming it, rebranding it, and hopefully thinking about it. Yeah, giving us auto updates. Because you know what? The web is actually really exciting now if you subtract Internet Explorer. Mm-hmm. Like, everything is up to date. Most features roll out, you know, pretty much at the same pace. JavaScript is faster. You know, CSS is actually, like, the Flexbox layout module exists now. So there's an actual layout module for CSS, so which is amazing. That didn't even exist unbelievably for years. We're just messing around with floats and clears and whatever nonsense we need to do to get the layouts working. But, and all of that stuff exists now. So it's like, and animations are making just stunning progress, CSS animations and transitions. And then even in JavaScript, they're doing a lot of work for animation performance and all of that. Yeah, the modern web is moving quickly. But yeah, Internet Explorer is just like this thorn in everybody's side. It's totally ridiculous that we still have to deal with that.
All right. Well, before we get to the picks, if people want to pick up your books, I think you have one or two other products. Do you want to just tell us about that real quick?
Oh, yeah. So the book, that's at sketchingwithcss.com. And the other thing that I do is call them escape plans. I only have one right now, but it's basically training for advanced developers to get up to speed with new stuff in a couple days. And the one that I do now is Angular. So if that's your thing, you can go check that out. That's, let's see, training.planningforaliens.com/Angular. And my blog is planningforaliens.com. I blog about mostly front-end web design stuff there. Sometimes businessy stuff. I like talking about that, how I go about doing that. So picks. I've never listened to a Ruby Rogues podcast before.
That's fine. We'll do the picks and then you can come.
It's okay. Neither have I.
Blasphemy.
Well, I'm not a Ruby developer. Was on my radar.
Fine. We forgive you.
I'm a Python developer.
All right.
Whoa. Okay.
Blasphemy again.
Yeah. We'll have to insert some significant white space into the podcast.
Yeah. That's his pick. That's his pick today is white space. White space.
All right, David, do you have some picks for us?
I do, actually. I'm going to pick a book. Addison Wesley sent me a copy of NoSQL Distilled by, I'm going to say this wrong, Pramod J. Satalaj and Martin Fowler. And I just want everybody that thinks they know what NoSQL is, just get this book and just read the first three chapters. I don't care if you finish the book. Just read the first three chapters because they tell you what NoSQL is and what NoSQL isn't. They explain why it's an unfortunate name. They explain why all of the things that you think are great about NoSQL, like you don't have to have a schema, you don't have to have migrations, you don't have to have data consistency. All of those are false. Those are myths. It's absolutely not true. And all of the reasons that you hate on NoSQL, like it being inconsistent or it not being, you know, controllable or it not being fast or whatever, you know, if you're going cutting across the grain or whatever, also false. It's all about how you use it and what the trade-offs are. They get into, in the first couple of chapters, they just explain the first chapters, just what they are and what the myths are. And then the chapters 2 and 3 talk about key value stores, column stores, for, you know, like vertical data stores, graph databases, that sort of thing, and how they work, what they are better at, like why a document database is actually better, or what a document database is better at than a key value store, you know, even though conceptually they're the same thing. So that's my first pick, is NoSQL Distilled. My next two picks are a little bit more playful. The first one is rot.js, which is the roguelike toolkit for JavaScript. So this is a toolkit that you can use to build basically roguelike games that will run in your browser. And it's completely open source, and you can basically go after the Amulet of Yendor in your browser. And then it's a toolkit that you can then write your own tweaks and hacks on top of the roguelike genre. And so very, very cool bit of retro gaming that you can get in your browser. My last pick is a new game. I have picked in the past the game Towns. If you can imagine Towns being set in the distant future, you end up with a game called The Spatials. And The Spatials is freaking awesome. You spend half your time playing SimCity, setting up a star base on an asteroid that visitors can come to, and you keep them happy, and they bring in money. And the other half is you build up your officers so that you can have away teams that go down to planets and do missions. And so there's an RPG element where you have like skills and abilities. Like every away team has to have a scientist and has to have a doctor and has to have, you know, that sort of thing. And you know, like Star Trek, you beam down and basically violate the prime directive left and right. And it's awesome. And it's almost a casual game. It's easy to pick up and put down. It's easy to start and stop. And it's also very, very, very addicting. So, you know, be ready for that. You might want to pick it up on a Friday, because I ended up playing it like all weekend, last weekend. And my wife was mad at me by the end of the weekend, but the game was freaking awesome. So I've had it for about 7 days, and I've logged 82 hours in the game. So yeah, I was in trouble. So those are my picks.
Very nice. Saran, what are your picks?
Sure. I have one. I don't know if you guys have seen theuserisdrunk.com. Yes. Awesome. Okay.
Oh, no.
I've seen it.
I was worried that you already knew what this was. So it's actually a really good idea, and it's an idea that I've had in a different format before, and I'm saying this to kind of scare you before I tell you what the idea actually is. So the concept behind it is that your website should be so simple and so well-designed, which kind of fits with the theme of today's podcast, that even a drunk person should use it. And so this guy, who's a UX professional and full-stack developer, he will, if you pay him, get drunk and use your website. And then
wow.
Yeah, and he'll give you, you know, notes and feedback on what his experience was like. And the difference between, you know, him and I think, you know, someone off the street doing it is he actually knows what he's talking about when he's sober. So, you know, what he says in his feedback is actually valuable and based on experience and his own work and stuff. But yeah, I thought it was a really cool idea. And I actually, have you guys heard of Drunk Kitchen?
No, but it makes me think it's got to involve a lot of sliced off fingers.
I actually don't know, but I would guess that too. So Drunk Kitchen is, that's going to be my second pick now. Drunk Kitchen is this woman whose name I can't remember, and she basically gets drunk and cooks. And it's just a video YouTube of her trying to cook while she's drunk. And it's hilarious. She like falls on the floor and, you know, just slurs her words. And it's really, really funny. Not that, you know, alcoholism is not good and drink responsibly and all that stuff. But within that context, they both seem awesome and very entertaining. So yeah, definitely check out theuserisdrunk.com and take a look at, if you're interested in seeing how drunk people will use your site, there's a service out there for you.
You know how that business meeting went, right? It's like, you know what I really like doing is getting drunk. You know, I wish I had a business model where I could get paid to get drunk.
What's funny is it started with him charging like $100 and now he charges like $500 because apparently he's kind of in demand at this point. So there's a market out there for people looking for drunk people using their site.
He's got to get to like $80,000 before he can get a new liver. So
yeah. You know, he's got a ways to go.
Price yourself accordingly to your capital assets.
Very cool. I've got a few picks that I want to share. I've been reading the Reckoner series by Brandon Sanderson, and I've really been enjoying those. They're kind of a, I'm not sure if they're like, it's like a sci-fi, but it, people have superpowers. I'm sure that there's a science element to it because they're trying to figure out why people have superpowers and how to stop them. And they, you know, they kill some of them that are called, they call them epics. Anyway, really, really interesting series. And I've really been enjoying that. So I'm going to pick those books. I want to have a technical pick, but I can't think of anything right now. I'm usually a little more prepared, but I was rebuilding a transmission with my father-in-law yesterday and I just didn't get time. So, I will, hand the microphone over to Sean. Sean, what are your picks?
Okay, so that Spatials game looks awesome. I'm totally going to waste my time playing that.
Yep, that's sorry.
Awesome. That's okay. that's awesome. Okay, so I run a very small product company, and I have a lot of friends that do the same thing. So I wanted to mention a couple of their small little things that they do that I think are pretty awesome. One was actually at the beginning, Chuck, you mentioned, so I go from the designer to programmer direction. What about from programmer to designer? And my friend Jared Drysdale does that very thing with his book called Bootstrapping Design, which I think is an awesome read for developers that want to just get up to speed on just enough about design so that they can become more fluent in that in design language. So that's one thing. There's another one. There's no way that you guys don't know about Jim Gay. Do you guys know him?
Jim who? I'm just kidding. He was a regular on the Freelancer show for a while.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So then you guys know about his new DSL book, which he's just finishing up. That's called Ruby DSL Handbook. So that's a new thing that he's doing. He's got another one called Clean Ruby. Then my friend Ryan Castillo wrote a book called 7 Recurring Revenue Recipes. That's at ryancastillo.org. It's not done yet. It's still a work in progress, but I've been talking with him about it, and I, you know, I'm just going out and doing consulting myself too, and there's some really awesome little nuggets in here for people building their own consulting businesses. Okay, and then this one you guys are all going to love if you ever do anything with Heroku and SSL. My friend Michael Buckby has a company called Expedited SSL, which essentially equals you click a button and he installs your certificate for you in your Heroku instance, and it automatically renews and everything. So none of the hassle with installing your SSL certificates. Nice. Yeah, that's a pretty awesome tool. And then I'm just going to mention one more totally random thing, since you guys were mentioning fairly random things. I didn't realize we could go totally like that, but I just finished this book called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, The Japanese Art of Decluttering and Organizing by Marie Kondo. And it is actually life-changing. I'm currently sitting in a completely decluttered basement right now, which is, I just did it yesterday. It's blowing my mind. It's totally awesome. So if your life is filled with clutter, I highly recommend this book. She has like everything that you could think of a reason for you to keep something. She has an awesome reason for you not to, and it's usually deeply philosophical and challenges your thinking about the stuff that you keep and have in your life. So that book is totally worth checking out. All right, those are my picks.
Awesome. Very cool. We're going to have Jim Gay on the show on June 2nd. We already have it scheduled. So
that's awesome.
Just thought I'd put that out there. I don't think we have any other announcements, so we'll go ahead and wrap up the show. Thank you for coming,
this
Sean.
This episode is sponsored by Matt Flory. You've been building software for a long time, and sometimes it gets a little overwhelming. Work piles up, hiring sucks, and it's hard to get projects out the door. Check out Matt Flory. They're a small shop with experience shipping big products. They're smart, dedicated, will augment your team, and work as hard as you do. Find them online at MattFlory.com or on Twitter at MattFlory. Hosting and bandwidth provided by the Blue Box Group. Check them out at bluebox.net. Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit cachefly.com to learn more. Would you like to join the conversation with the rogues and their guests? Want to support the show? We have a forum that allows you to join the conversation and support the show at the same time. You can sign up at rubyrogues.com/parlay.